Dr. Ravigupta, who's to share with us some readings from the Bhagavad Gita Purana.
Thank you.
There you go.
Thank you.
It's as simple as that.
So, today's reading, I'm going to start off by not reading, but saying a few things before we get into the actual reading, just to set the groundwork a bit for what we're going to do with the text. And what I want to talk about initially is the process of translation itself, and some. Thank you. This is yours. And some observations from the translation experience, as Dr. Valpe and myself have been going through. Just as a little bit of a background, I think I mentioned this at the beginning of my first lecture here, we're working on a collaborative project, a translation of selections from the Bhagavata Purana. This is going to be very, very selected, 1,400 verses in a text that's about 14,000 verses in length. So it's about 10% of the book. And alongside with that, that reader is going to be a companion volume that's a collection of articles which we're editing together, done by scholars who are studying the Bhagavata Purana from different disciplinary perspectives. So we're looking at Bhagavata in performance, Bhagavata in theology and philosophy, in cosmology, and so on. And the idea with the two books is that they're going to be keyed in together. So the first, the readings are selected. One of the criteria for selection is the articles found in the second volume, and the second volume will make reference to passages which we translate in the first. So we're working our way gradually through the process of translation. The companion volume is coming along quite well, but the translation takes a bit of time. And there are a number of things that I and we have been thinking about as we go through translation. And I want to bring those out, highlight them a little bit, so that we can pay attention to them as we're reading the text. And hopefully it's also useful beyond just these passages in particular, talking about more of a perspective on how we translate a text like the Bhagavata Purana. Now, the Bhagavata is difficult in several ways. For one thing, the language is often archaic in nature, and Van Buitenen has a good article describing the archaism of the Bhagavata Purana and how it intentionally uses Vedic forms in order to tie itself to the Vedic tradition. And along with that comes vocabulary that is rarely found elsewhere, and sometimes never found outside the Bhagavata. So there's no dictionary you could turn to for it, or you could turn to a dictionary, but the dictionary would give solely that verse you're working on as the reference for. So it's a circular endeavor. And their commentaries are what help you out. Thank you. And then on top of that, the Sanskrit is very beautiful, and Bhagavata is often compared to Kavya. It's more than just Purana. The Puranas typically, if you're familiar with that type of literature, are very simple, usually Anushtubh verses and just very simple in structure, telling stories, focusing a lot on plot and narrative rather than on philosophical things. Definitely not a whole lot of complicated stuff, or even the complicated material is presented in a straightforward way. The Bhagavata is consciously, it's very much not like that. The Sanskrit is beautiful. It's especially as you start moving later in the text, it becomes very, very elaborate and very a huge variety of different metrical forms are used. Very unusual, and some beautiful verses that are like I said, not frequently found elsewhere. So for all these reasons, the Bhagavata is not an easy text to translate. And the last thing I should mention is its philosophical sophistication. The Bhagavata really makes an attempt at systematic philosophical thought in many of its places. It's not obviously, you know, a work of philosophy, but sometimes it seems like that when you're reading it. Now, in translating a work like this, or in any book, there's a few issues that come to mind. One thing that we've been thinking about regularly is insider versus outsider perspectives during the process of translation. Those of a practitioner, rather than a practitioner, perhaps we could say a religious reader. And Paul Griffiths has a nice book on religious reading in which he talks about what that constitutes. But the manner in which a religious person reads scripture, a religious reader is very different than the way academics tend to read, we tend to read our books. Even though it might be the same book that both are reading, religious reading is very often, the most frequent metaphor used for religious reading is gustatory in nature. Just eating and drinking. And the Bhagavata, of course, begins with this. Bhagavatam rasamalayam muhuraho rasika bhuvibhavuka. O connoisseurs of rasa, drink this rasa, which is the Bhagavata. And that's how it, you know, enter into this text, by drinking. Whereas, according to Griffiths, the dominant academic model of reading is a consumerist one. You look at a work, you look for, you read it for what you're looking for, and once you find it, then you set it aside, move on. And so it's a limited, it's a circumscribed, it's a delimited process, whereas the process of religious reading continues endlessly. So, for example, commentators spending significant amounts of time drawing out every possible implication from a verse, even impossible implications from a verse, just things that you would go, well, this is really stretching what's there. I mean, how would you get this? It's impossible. And yet they see it there. They find it there. And from the perspective of the academic reader, that can seem very unreasonable in terms of what's being done. But from the perspective of the religious reader, that's exactly what needs to be done. And if each successive commentator cannot contribute more to that process of reading by drawing yet more from a text, which then that commentator is not doing what he's supposed to for his readers. So the commentator, in other words, becomes the most important, the primary religious reader. And in some sense, he's reading for his readers, reading on behalf of them, and showing them what a religious reader needs to do. So thinking of commentary as religious reading and commentators as religious readers in this circumstance. Insider versus outsider. The Bhagavata has, it is conscious of these perspectives in some ways. Right at the beginning, you find the Bhagavata drawing those who stand outside the text into the world of the Bhagavata. And this is seen in that verse I just quoted. This is verse number three. Pipata bhagavatam rasamalayam muhuraho rasika bhuvibhavuka. That drink this rasa of the Bhagavata. And kind of asking the reader to move into the text and saying, this is the adhikara, this is that person is worthy who knows how to distinguish rasa, right? Rasika and bhavuka, someone who knows sentiment, emotion, and is aware of that. So the Bhagavata is kind of drawing the reader in and saying, come into this world, which is basically full of rasa, and there's no inside or outside. That's kind of that that distinction has collapsed in some sense. That verse, Pivata Bhagavatam Rasamalam, drink this Nigama Kalpataror Galitam Phalam. This is the fruit of the tree of Nigama, of the Vedas, and you can drink it. And Sridhar Swami, in his commentary, says, well, how can you drink a fruit? Right? It's even if it's galitam phalam, if it's hanging on a tree, how can you drink that fruit? Is it pibata, the wrong word to use here? And Sridhara Swami says, no, it's not. This is a fruit with no peel and no seed. It's simply a fruit made of pulp or juice, and therefore you can drink it. It's basically juice. And such a fruit is unfathomable, but that's the nature of the fruit of the Bhagavatam. In other words, is there an inside? Is there an outside? Well, he's saying there's no outside. If you want to experience this fruit, you have to drink it. You have to experience it. You have to take it into yourself. So there's this pull inward in the Bhagavata, but there's also a push outward and a consciousness that the text needs to relate to the world out there, to an outsider's position. And this you find, again, early on in the text when there's a description of Vyasa's samadhi, his trance. Vyasa's just written all the Vedas, and he's written Mahabharata, etc., and or compiled them, or arranged them, he's still feeling dissatisfied, doesn't know, depressed, really, doesn't know what to do. And Narada comes and he says, the reason you're feeling depressed is because you have not described the activities of the Lord. You haven't described bhakti. And all this dharma that you talk about is not worth very much. So Vyasa says, okay, and he enters into a trance. Now, in that trance, what he sees is described in three verses. Or two and a half verses, really. And commentators find this extremely important because they say, since everything in the Bhagavata is a product of Vyasa's trance, therefore, the content of the trance, as it's described in two and a half verses, is in effect a summary of the entire text, and it's all found there. And this endeavor to unpack everything from something very little is a very, very standard commentarial drive in Indian commentary. There's this book by
Henderson.
In which he talks about Chinese commentary, and he kind of he talks about this push, this urge to increase the canon and make it encyclopedic and add more and more and more and more to it until it becomes encyclopedic, until everything is contained within it. There's nothing outside the range of that text. And that's true, of course, in commentary in general, but the Indian tradition of commentary kind of has an opposite push. It's still trying to be encyclopedic in nature, but trying to find that spectrum, that range, in as tiny a space as possible. And so if you can find the entire Bhagavata in the Chatushloki, in the four, this is why Chatushloki, Chatusutri, this groups of little four little verses are so popular. Everything has to have a little essence from which you can unpack the whole text. Okay, four verses. How about the two and a half verses of Vyasa Samadhi? That should contain the entire text. How about just the first verse of the Bhagavata? That should have the content of the entire work. How about just the first word or the first phrase, right? And this is, you know, this is how it works, is you unpack as much as possible from what's inside. Anyhow, in Vyasa Samadhi, two and a half verses, the entire kind of content is supposed to be there, according to commentators. But the conclusion of his samadhi is Lokasya Janato Vidvangsh Chakre Satvata Sanghitam. Seeing the ignorant masses of people, seeing the sufferings of others, Anartho Pashamam Sakshat, and seeing how they could be removed by the process of bhakti, bhakti yoga madhokshaje, he Chakre Satvata Sanghitam, he wrote this Satvata Samhita, this Bhagavata Purana. Right. So, yes, the text is a privileged space. it's a, you know, in some sense a very private, a very esoteric realm. You have to enter it, drink it, experience it. But also, yes, it needs to make sense outside. There's an outward push as well. And so our companion volume on the Bhagavata is therefore basically divided into two parts. The world of the Bhagavata and the Bhagavata in the world. Because you find both of these pushes in these urges in the text of the Bhagavata. Yes, Parikshit is drawn to enter the work because he's going to die. But at the same time, his question is about what is of relevance to the world. Right? He's a king, and we've already talked about in the lectures of how important kingship is in the text and how important the situation of the world is and how much of a concern that is. So that's a bit of a reflection on insider-outsider issues in terms of the Bhagavata itself. Of course, one could discuss this in terms of the translators, but I'm not going to go into that today, at least not immediately. You know, where does the translator stand? But the text itself has insider-outsider and also blurs the boundary between the two, collapses them. That's the first thing I wanted to point out in terms of general issues of translation, something a translator needs to be conscious of. The second issue is of fidelity to the text. How can you be faithful to the text that you're working on? Are you more faithful if you capture the exact sentence structure, the grammatical structure, the meaning in the sense of, you know, direct dictionary correspondence? Or are you being more faithful to the text if you're able to convey the power of the poetry, for example, or the suggestions, the meanings that are embedded within the poetry? Who's being more faithful to the text? And here, a very useful analysis is found in an article that Dr. Valpe pointed out to me by, what's his name now? McElhanon, Kenneth McElhanon, in which he talks about, qualitative translation, and do you remember the other one? I should have printed that out. I can look it up, actually, I have it, I'll look it up later. But anyhow, this problem of how far do you need to go in one direction or the other? What's your primary goal or primary intent? That's a difficult one, especially with a book like the Bhagavata, because the Bhagavata is so much more than simply descriptive or even prescriptive. Right? The Bhagavata really conveys a powerful poetry. And can you convey that power in prose, for example? We've chosen to do a prose translation. And can you convey the power of the text? Well, some would say no. For example, Graham Schweig in his translations, he, as far as I know, he always chooses to do poetry if it is a verse that he's translating. And for him, that's very significant. Where if you look at Edwin Bryant's translation, it's pretty straightforward prose. And his intent is a lot more on the correspondence side rather than the qualitative translation. So the key is, of course, finding a balance between these two. But you do have to choose your preference. In other words, you will end up more on one side or the other. No one, as far as I know, has struck the perfect balance, or at least convinced others that they have done so. So you're going to end up in one side or another. For example, one thing that Schweig, in his translation of the Gita, makes a point of, and he's very articulate about this, explicit about it, rather, is whenever there's a Sanskrit word which is based on a certain verbal root, say kr, so you have karya and karma and karana and so many other words derived from kr, then he will always translate it using the same verbal root in English. The choice he makes, I believe, is act. And so it'll be action and acting and act and so on. Regardless of how it shows up, he's just like the Sanskrit does it, he's going to, you know. And that's, of course, very effective in some ways, because it allows the text to have a certain resonance and repetition to it that is lost if sometimes you do act and sometimes you translate it as make and sometimes as do and sometimes as other things. You can't see that the importance of kr, the power of that running through. And in a work like the Upanishads or the Gita, this is crucial because these are meditative texts and they consciously repeat certain words. Krishna plays with the root kr in multiple ways in a single verse. And a lot of those, I mean, it's the idea, it's clear that he's trying to say a bunch of things with kr in it. He's actually enjoying the alliteration there, the resonance, the various, and making a point of kind of absorbing ourselves, our understanding, karma, right, action in this world and how important it is. So translating it like that in English, so you have the word act six times in that verse, is powerful. Right? It's very useful. At the same time, it brings disadvantages, right? Because the range of meanings, the semantic range in a word in Sanskrit, like kar, is going to say, it's going to extend from here to here. Kar can mean do and make and act and go on. This might be the range, right? And the range for the word act in English may be equally large, but it may be here. Right? It may be off. So when you've got kar being used in this sense, then to apply it to act in this category is pushing it. Right? It's really stretching it. And people have pointed that out. Well, sometimes you're really pushing it if you insist on translating kr as act. So you're going to lose something there of that correspondence, that direct translation that you aspire for. Okay, just as an illustration of how issues of fidelity to the text can be actually very difficult ones. And some we have to make choices as translators for that, and you can't win on all grounds. It's some places it's going to be weak. And then even if you strive, okay, suppose you do strive to make keep a direct correspondence as far as possible in terms of meaning between the text and what you're translating. And if you sacrifice on the poetry and so forth, then you don't mind so much. Suppose you make that choice, and so you want to get a direct and basic translation. Well, what constitutes a direct and basic translation? Because, again, I've encountered this a lot in doing the Bhagavata. In a particular verse that is very rich in its in the ways it can be understood, in the range of meanings, in the language that it's used, commentators will draw a whole variety of different interpretations of that verse. Okay, and some you can put aside and say, well, this is clearly very interesting, but I wouldn't count this as, immediately present within the text I'm translating. Okay, but in other cases, it's not so clear. A commentator is able to grammatically, in terms of vocabulary, in terms of sentence structure, translate a verse or describe it, interpret it in a particular way. And another commentator is able to do it in a different way, often a very different way. And both are equally substantiable by, rules of Sanskrit grammar. And both seem to be eminently reasonable. This usually in the Bhagavata doesn't occur for entire verses, in that where the Bhagavata is not like, like poets would do. It's not trying to intentionally write a verse that can be read in two completely different ways. What's that called? Shlesha. Right? It's not, usually not, most of the time. Maybe there's a few instances of that later on in the 10th book. But the Bhagavata is not intentionally trying to do that for an entire verse. But you do get a compound, for example, or a phrase that can be most reasonably translated in three different ways depending on which commentator you're following. And so it really raises the question of what's the meaning of the text really becomes what commentator do you choose to follow. That becomes the question. Because some commentators, of course, you won't, because they're too far afield. But say two or three of them, pretty reasonable, right? So if you suggest that I'm going to take only the direct literal corresponding meaning of the text, well, you're kind of, deceiving yourself a bit. Because whether you realize it or not, you may be making a certain interpretive choice that has been made by Sridhara Swami, for example, or Vijayadvaja Tirtha or Vishwanath Chakravarti. And so that's where this ties back to the insider-outsider issue. That's where this question of one's parampara or sampradaya becomes important. You can see why commentators, traditions grounded in the Bhagavata insist on reading the text within a particular parampara, because sometimes it does become a question of just who are you going to take. And in the history of Bhagavata translation, it's been almost always Sridhara. Sridhara Swami is it. I mean, his is the meaning of the Bhagavata, and then others are variants that, to the extent that they correspond with Sridhara, they're approaching the actual meaning of the text. This has kind of been the assumption, which Sheridan points out in an article in the Journal of Vaishnava Studies, in which he says, perhaps Bhagavata studies needs to move beyond that a bit, and we need to hear what the Bhagavata itself has to say, or what Bhagavata has to say when read from the framework or lens of another commentator. Okay, so these two things, insider-outsider perspectives and issues of fidelity to the text. The third and last general comment I want to make before we do some translation is collaborative translation. because these things are complicated further by our choice of doing this as a collaborative project. Now, there are great advantages to something like to a collaborative translation project. For one thing, the Bhagavata is eminently suited for such collaborative enterprise. Because of the Bhagavata's strengths in a variety of different areas, like its poetic abilities, its philosophical abilities, its, like that. Using the expertise and strengths of multiple translators works very well. Because a lot of different specialists are able to bear on the translation itself, come to bear. And so that's a big advantage. A second advantage, of course, is the process of continuous revision and checking by the other person, which of course can be done if you're not working collaboratively with someone, but I don't think it can be done with the same level of quality, because when you have two people who are equally committed to the project, that's a big advantage. They read the text with a very different eye than someone reading your translation because they're doing you a favor. So that constant back and forth really it helps. the human reason behind it is that it's very motivating and a lot more enjoyable, more fun, you can motivate the other person to work when they become slack, and when you do work together, it's actually wonderful.
When who becomes slack?
when the presenter, the speaker of this present lecture becomes slack, then the other person who sits to his right can then motivate to do more. And so forth. So collaborative translation brings a lot of inherent benefits to it. At the same time, there's also difficulties associated with it. And I don't mean the translators not getting along, because that, I suppose, we don't have to deal with. The question of developing the same voice. For example, Professor Valpe has a way of writing, a style of writing, and I have a style of writing, and we translate with the same goals in mind, largely, but the voices are very different. And if we're translating one chapter each, or sections of a chapter even, then you don't want the reader to notice that too much. Some of it's okay, but you don't want to go from one chapter to another and go, oh, what? And there's of course, a level of consistency that's required just in terms of certain conventions of translations. What do you want to do with words like dharma and rasa and lila and so forth? Are we going to leave them in the original? Are we going to translate them? How are we going to translate them, etc.? So there's a certain level of consistency that's required, but beyond consistently also there's the translator's voice. And in a good collaborative environment, this can be worked out by both sides working on each other's translation. But that makes it a lot more time-consuming also, because you can do your translation, and off it goes to press after, say, one person reads an external reader. But in collaborative translation, it can be a process of back and forth at least once, but maybe twice. And that makes it more time-consuming, trying to bring both sides, both voices together. Fortunately, when there's a happy working relationship, a good relationship between the individuals, as there is in this case, then that in itself is also enjoyable in terms of a process. There's a certain protocol that we developed in order to do that kind of collaborative work. And I want to share that with you, just to get your thoughts on it. This is all very much a work in progress, as you can see. But if you, this packet I'm giving you, if you could turn to the very last page. We'll get to the translation in a minute. If you could turn to the last place, which says methods. And I'll just read this with you. It'll be faster than me paraphrasing it. The Bhagavata Purana is a difficult work to translate. The text often employs an intentionally archaic style, using rare terms and employs sophisticated meters more appropriate to Sanskrit Gavya than the Purana. The Bhagavat is eminently suited to collaborative translation, for collaborative work allows one to bring a wide range of knowledge and skills to bear on this variegated text. We have therefore developed a translation protocol which will ensure a consistent, high quality of translation and allow us to deal effectively with any difficulties that are encountered. This comes from a draft grant proposal for this project, so I apologize for the finality and the victorious nature of the language. This will ensure a consistent high quality. To all of you, I'd say we hope this would bring about a decent quality of translation. But you can't say that in a grant proposal. First, a set of approximately 100 verses. In practice, we've been doing much less than that at a go. But a set of approximately 100 verses is translated individually by a single translator. So this is an important choice, because another option is that there could be just the decision made that both translators always translate together. For example, I was recently speaking to Frank Clooney, who's working with Archana Venkateshan at the University of California, Davis, on a translation of the Tiruvaimoli for, I forget the publisher. But this is a project that Frank has had in mind for a long time, and he's now working with her, and she's also a specialist in this text. And they made a decision that all their translation is going to happen together, right, in one place. And so they meet whenever they can but our decision was we each translate independently. Then the translator highlights any sections of the text that have posed particular problems. Then the first translator, T1, also reads commentaries concurrently and adds notes where they would illuminate the text for the English reader. Upon completion, the first draft is posted on Central Desktop, the software program that we're employing to facilitate collaborative work. That software program has now been is now died for us.
Retired,
that's the word I was looking for. We're now using something simple like Google Docs to work on. It was easier than Central Desktop.
Cheaper
also. Yeah, cheaper also. And Central Desktop had this annoying habit of sending you reminders that you haven't done your work. Which would show up every day. And, this is a bit nagging, I guess. The second translator reads this first draft and posts suggested corrections, paying special attention to any problems identified by the first translator, so focusing on those highlighted areas. The second translator then initiates discussion on any of the suggested changes and then signs off on the revised translation. The revised draft is then sent to an external reader, usually a traditional scholar of Sanskrit in India who possesses expertise in the content of this section, to make sure that we weren't kind of straying too far from the text or the tradition of commentary. And the reason I wrote that is we had Professor Narasimhachari in mind, who's been a Shiv Dasani fellow on a couple accounts here at the center and is very good with this type of thing. Any suggested changes are weighed and carried out by the first translator. The translation is now read a final time by the second translator, primarily with the intention of ensuring consistency in translation style. And then finally, the first translator writes a brief introduction to that section, an English introduction for the readers. That's kind of the protocol we developed to manage collaborative translation, and it's yet to be seen how effective it is. But so far, I guess the main change we've made from this process is that the review by the second translator usually occurs together with the first translator. So that part we do together. In other words, if I'm reading Ken's translation or he's reading mine, then we get together either virtually or, I mean, on cyberspace or in person to go through it, rather than the second translator looking at it independently on their own. Because it's a lot easier for the second reader to just ask, well, why did you translate in this way? There must have been a good reason, rather than having to recreate it from scratch. So that's something that I would amend in this protocol here. Okay, so that's it for my general comments about translation method and theory and approach to the text, specifically the Bhagavatam. And this has lasted us 37 minutes, 42 minutes. Look at the watch, I guess. Before we proceed into the text itself, does anyone have any comments or questions or suggestions to what I've said? Anything strikes you as you know, inefficient or inappropriate, or you should look at this? Because some of what I described you, we discussed recently to put into an introduction for this volume. And so, you know, anything you could suggest or comment or even questions you could ask would help us a lot in thinking through this introduction.
It looks like you've got a very rigorous process in your translation strategy. So in that spectrum that you spoke about between a literal translation and poetry, you have to give up poetry for meaning or meaning for poetry, usually. So where on the spectrum do you think you're...
I was afraid someone would ask that. I stood back and kind of discussed the problem. That's something that we've not really... I guess we have a sense of it, but we haven't articulated it as clearly as I guess we should. But we are tending more to the literal side than the poetry side. Our choice not to translate it in English verse, for example... but also, yeah, just trying very hard to keep to the text. At the same time, one of the reasons we started on this project to begin with is because the translation most frequently quoted by academics, namely Tagare's translation in English, is, we feel, too far on the side of literalism. And he tries so hard to maintain the structure of the Sanskrit that it's not good literature. Mm. When you read it, you have to read it a verse three times in order to make sense.
So it's unreadable. It's
yeah.
not translation.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, we don't want to go that far. So our intent was to move more in the direction of poetry. But we're definitely not going as far as, say, Schweig does in his translation of the Rasa Lila Panchadhyayi, his Dance of Divine Love, where he agonized over every word of his translation to make sure that it still has, it has the right suggestive power in addition to, you know, which is appropriate for a text like the Rasa Lila Panchadhyayi, which is perhaps the richest in terms of its power of poetry in the Bhagavata Purana. But we can't see ourselves doing that for, say, the second book of the Bhagavata, you know, or more philosophical texts. Part of it is simply that our project is a lot larger in scope in terms of translation, and we can't afford to be that careful about the poetic side. So the reason I wanted to say all this beforehand is because there are some verses that we'll see in this seminar and the next one, where I really felt that I lost a lot in my translation, because the verse is beautiful, and the implications that the commentators bring out as a result of that is really, really nice. But you don't get that. You read that verse, that translation as a simple statement of plot, and then she did this, and it occurred like this, and the whole lyricism of it is, not all of it, but a lot of it is gone. Yeah. So I would say we're on the spectrum. You know, if there's an imaginary balance, then we're on the side of the literal more. What would you say?
Yeah. But I think we also have, as you mentioned, Tagari, I think we have more sensitivity to a readable English than he had. And that, as you said, was the reason, one of our selling points, really,
yeah.
that the book should be done. So,
and sometimes, all the terms,
well, yeah, but sometimes I think we also hit upon some fairly poetic English now and then.
Yes. We try for that as far as possible. To, a lot of what we do in the second phase of reviewing the other person's translation is often not so much about the Sanskrit itself. It is a lot about, you know, how do you translate this passage, or what does this mean, or what's the grammatical structure here. But I'd say at least 50% is saying, is there a better way to put this? Is there some way in which this verse begins with a question, right? Kva ham mandamater, you know, who am I? Where am I to be... could we begin our translation by that question, just to convey the punch that the verse carries? Right? So I'd say at least half of what we do is that kind of restatement, saying, you know, this is we need to convey more of the power there. So it's striving for that balance, but perhaps aware that we can't actually achieve it perfectly. Any other questions, comments? Okay. What I have for us to look at is Book 3, Chapter 15 of the Purana. This is starting from verse 12, because that's where the story that I'm interested in begins. This is the episode of Jaya and Vijaya falling from Vaikuntha. And fall here is literal. I mean, the text talks about how they actually fall from Vaikuntha, and as they fall, the various devas at different levels, ha ha kara, there's a big outcry. Oh boy, these people are gasp. Oh no, where do they go? Such accomplished individuals falling to earth. So it's the story of their fall, and I'm not going to summarize the story, because all of you were present at my earlier lectures, and you know that story. I summarized it there. The section I want to read today, depending on how far we can get, is the prelude to the curse and fall, which is the punch of the chapter. This is the beginning, describing Vaikuntha, Vishnu's world, because this whole story occurs as a result of the Kumaras, Sanak Sanatan, Sanandan, and Sanat, the sons of Brahma, going to Vaikuntha to see Vishnu. They've never seen Vishnu before. They've heard a lot about him, and they want to see what he is like. They want to have darshan there. And so with that desire, they're heading to Vaikuntha, and therefore Brahma describes this world. The larger frame, the context here, is Brahma speaking to the devas, to the gods, because the gods have come to him saying, this whole world is thrown in chaos, the light of the sun is going dark, everything is upside down, what's going on? They're in a panic situation, they think the world's coming to an end. And Brahma says, no, nothing like that's happening. It's just Diti is carrying the two most dangerous asuras, or daityas, in this world, Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha. Their power is such that they're obscuring the light of the sun and throwing everyone into darkness, even within the womb. And in order to explain why they are so powerful, he says, okay, here's how the story started. These two are actually associates, they're parishadas of Vishnu in Vaikuntha. And this is how they fell, and they fell into the womb of Diti, and so on. So Brahma is speaking to his sons, not to his sons, to the devas, about his sons, the four Kumaras, and their journey to Vaikuntha. And in order to explain why the Kumaras would want to go to Vaikuntha, he's giving a description of Vaikuntha, which is very beautiful, very, very eloquent. And so what I thought is today we could read that description, and then the next seminar we could read the actual curse and blaming part, which will tie back to our settings. In order to get us started, let's read together. I'm going to read aloud for you my own translation, which has been reviewed by, it's been through this process. It's not a final version, as you'll see by certain gray areas. It still needs some working. It's a draft, but it's been through part one and part two of that process that I just outlined. Okay, and I'm going to read till verse 26, so a page and a half. Brahma said, my sons, Sanaka and the others, Sanatan, Sanandan, and Sanat, were born from my mind and are your older brothers. Free of desire, they wander the worlds through the sky and amongst people. I should mention that parentheses means that it's information added by us. Okay. This book is directed towards undergraduate readers as well as scholars, so there's a little bit more of an explanation we do than perhaps might be necessary for others. One day, those pure souls went to that place, worshipped by all people, Vaikuntha, the residence of the Blessed Lord, Vaikuntha, Vishnu. All the people who live there have Vaikuntha bodies, and they worship Hari by virtuous acts that are not motivated by any aspiration. And there dwells Bhagavan, the original person, who is understood through scripture. The virtuous Lord is situated in goodness that is free of passion, and he delights us, his own people. The forest called Naishreyas sparkles there with wish-fulfilling trees that possess the beauty of all seasons. Indeed, this forest is the embodiment of absolute bliss. The residents of Vaikuntha travel with their wives in aerial cars, continuously singing about the Lord's activities which destroy sin. They ridicule the breeze that carries the fragrance of sweet Madhavi flowers blossoming in the water because it breaks their meditation. The tumult of peacocks, partridges, parrots, swans, gallinules, shell ducks, saris cranes, cuckoos, and pigeons briefly stops when the chief black bee hums loudly, as if singing the stories of Hari, Vishnu. And the reverse side of that page. Flowering plants in Vaikuntha: coral jasmine, freshwater mangrove, Spanish cherry, rose chestnut, Alexandrian laurel, teak, champaka magnolia, blue water lily, barleria, star jasmine, and Indian coral tree. Greatly honor the austerities of Tulsi, the holy basil, for her fragrance is privileged by Vishnu, who decorates himself with Tulsi leaves. Vaikuntha is crowded with aerial cars made of Vaiduya gems, emeralds, and gold, which can be gained simply by bowing to Hari's feet. Ladies with lovely smiling faces and large hips do not incite passion by their smiles, etc., in those whose minds are fixed on Krishna. The beautiful and faultless Sri Lakshmi, whose grace others exert themselves, seems to be dusting the gold-lined crystal walls in Hari's house with her play lotus, the anklets on her lotus-like feet tinkling. O gods, attended by her maidservants, Sri was worshipping the Lord in her garden with tulsi leaves. There she saw her face, with its beautiful locks of hair and prominent nose, in crystal-clear ponds that had coral banks and nectar-like water, and thought, "My face was kissed by the Blessed Lord." Those who listen to useless discussion on topics other than the accounts of Hari's creative acts do not approach Vaikuntha. Such discussion is devoid of substance, it destroys good judgment, and it is heard by unfortunate persons who are thrown into dark worlds without refuge. Even if we gods ask for a human birth, wherein both dharma and knowledge of the truth, even we gods ask for a human birth, wherein both dharma and knowledge of the truth are obtainable. Alas, those who have attained human birth but do not worship that blessed Lord are bewildered by extensive maya. Those who are devoted to the most excellent among the gods, Vishnu, leave far away the punishments of hell and go instead to Vaikuntha, which is beyond even us, the gods. Indeed, we desire their virtuous qualities. While describing their master's glorious fame to each other, they become overwhelmed with love. Their voices falter because of tears, and their bodies become thrilled with joy. In all the worlds, Vaikuntha alone is praiseworthy. That extraordinary divine place is ruled by the universal teacher and illumined by wonderful aerial cars carrying the best of the wise. Now that the four sages had arrived in Vaikuntha by the strength of their yogic power, they felt the highest happiness. So we'll stop there. Any questions about the plot line or what's going on? What the verses are basically saying?
Okay. What's Vaiduya? Why don't you translate Vaiduya gems?
I have a footnote on that. Let me see what the footnote says. I couldn't find a translation for Vaiduya. And the footnote says here, where'd it go? Yeah. Vaiduya gems are said to change color like alexandrite or certain kinds of garnet and spinel. So it's a type of gem that changes color in a very bright way. And it's a gem I don't think that one could dig out of the earth. At least in Kali Yuga.
So you could put color-changing gems or something.
Yeah.
Rainbow gems.
Well, yeah. Yeah, precious stones that change color when the sun shines on them.
Yeah. I just wasn't sure whether I was prepared to choose one of them for... I did a bit of research on color-changing gems, and the ones I came out with was alexandrite, garnet and spinel. Yeah. certain kinds of garnet, not all garnet. I mean, the regular garnet you get doesn't, but certain kinds do. Also, Vaiduria has the sense of being a wish-fulfilling gem as well, at times. So I could say something like a color-changing, wish-fulfilling gem. that could be translated. Also, you notice we did not translate Maya. There are a few words that we decided not to translate because they are elaborated in the companion volume. So there's an article on Maya supposed to be coming from Mr. Gopal Gupta. So we're assuming that it'll be sufficiently unpacked. And to say illusion here would be a bit odd.
It reminds me of the Sutta Vyuha, the Buddhist Pure Land text.
In terms of the richness of the description.
All the gems and everything.
Right. Okay. So, now, let's read Sanskrit.
Just a note to verse 17.
Uh-huh.
We might want to change the word ridicule to chide.
Uh-huh.
Because there's the reason they're doing whatever they're doing is because the fragrance of sweet Madhavi flowers breaks their meditation.
Right.
And that wouldn't be a reason to ridicule someone. It would
right.
be a reason to chide them.
Like you would a child who keeps disturbing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It's a good point.
Kind of mildly scolded.
Very good. I'll make a note of that. Child.
Is this the text you have to read?
Yes. Yes. except the scans themselves are...
Printout doesn't work.
Yeah, the printout is not as good. But let me just show you here. What page does this... 571, right?
It's okay, because we won't be doing this.
Yeah. Let me just show you what... The scans are actually pretty decent. Thanks to... here... So, okay, here's the scan itself, which is very tiny. But thanks to this great viewer, which Dr. Valpe told me about, called Fastone, you can, and it's none of that messy extra stuff. You can kind of keep going at it, if you like. If this were a manuscript, it would be very useful. We don't need such detail, usually. One is enough. So I'll have an improper advantage here as we read. Okay. So let's begin with... Okay, verse 12 you don't have, right? Let's begin with verse 13. एकदा भगवतो वैकुंठस्यामलात्मनः ययुर् वैकुंठनिलयं सर्वलोक नमस्कृतम्. Okay, these first few don't have a lot of commentarial attention. They're just kind of describing the basic background of the story here. One day those pure souls went to that place worshipped by all people, Vaikuntha, the residence of the Blessed Lord Vaikuntha. And the only thing that commentators note here is that the word Vaikuntha is being used in two senses to describe both the location, the world, and also the ruler of that world, who is Vishnu. So Vaikuntha here functions as a proper name for Vishnu. Next one. Vasanti yatra purusha sarve vaikuntha murtaya ye nimitta nimittena dharmena radhayan harim. All the people who live there have Vaikuntha bodies, and they worship Hari by virtuous acts that are not motivated by any aspiration. Sridhar Swami, if you look at his commentary on verse 14, he says, He says, Vasanti ityadi dvadashabihi. Basically, beginning with this verse, Vasanti, which we just read, verse 14, the next 12 verses are describing Vaikuntha.
You might have to explain how this text...
Oh, yes, sorry. I do apologize. That's a good point. So, the structure of what you have here, on the first page and the second page, the type in big letters, okay, up here, this is the text itself of the Bhagavata. So, all the big font stuff. And this edition provides four or five or a chunk of verses, basically, anywhere from 2 to 5 or 6 in one go. And then all the commentaries on that set of 3, 4, or 5 verses. And the reason for this is because not every commentator comments on every verse, and sometimes they choose to comment on 2 or 3 verses together, so things naturally go in little nuggets, and it's convenient to do it that way. Then after you get the original text, as you see 13 and 14 on the previous page and 15 and 16 here, then you have commentaries by different acharyas. Sridhara Swami is listed first. He's the oldest extant commentary, right? Commentator.
Madhva's maybe smaller.
Yeah, Madhva's older, but Madhva's not included here because he doesn't exactly do a running commentary. It corresponds to the order of the text, but it would be an active interpretation to tie specific passages with the verses themselves. Then you have Vamshidhara, who gives the Bhavartha Deepika Prakasha, which is a sub-commentary in Sridhara Swami. And then it goes on from there. In my translation of this chapter, I was primarily interested in Sridhara Swami and Vida Raghavacharya, who's from the Sri Vaishnava tradition, and Vijayadvaja Tirtha, who's a Madhva. And then the Gaudiya ones, Jiva Goswami, Vishwanath Chakravarti, as well as Vallabha. So those are kind of the big name translators, you could say. And then there's others given here also, which are very useful sometimes. Sometimes they're a lot simpler in their approach. For example, there's one called, what's his name? Giridhara, who's he wrote the Bala Prabhodini, which leads us to think that he's also a follower of Vallabha. His commentary is given right after Vallabha's. And his,
do you have Vallabha's commentary here?
No. I didn't copy Vallabha's commentary because it's much too extensive. He's developing a whole systematic theology grounded on the Bhagavata. And he's doing that... whereas other commentators, their commentary assumes their theology. Vallabha actually builds his theology in a much more direct way from the Bhagavata, and so it becomes very, very elaborate. And so, unfortunately, we don't have kind of time to work through his... I will, though, point out a few places where he makes very interesting comments that are different from what the others say. There's also a lot of overlap between commentators. They're by no means every... I mean, the policy amongst commentators is not the other commentator said this, therefore I have to find something different to say. Rather, the general assumption is, let's incorporate especially what Sridhara Swami said, but also others, and I'm going to layer it to build upon that. So there's a lot of overlap also. You don't necessarily have to read every commentary to the fullest extent. Looking at Sridhara Swami's commentary, which is the first one there, you see it's divided by verse. You have 13. You have the commentary for verse 13, and then you have the double bars, and it says 13. And then you have the commentary for the next verse, and then double bars says 14. So the commentary on a verse always comes before the number of that verse, just as it does in the original text. So he says, Tang varnayati vasanti ityadi dvadashabhi. So the next 12 verses are basically a description of Vaikuntha, beginning with Vasanti. Vaikuntasya harer iva murtir yeshang te. this verse is talking about those persons whose bodies, murtis, are vaikunthasya harer eva, which are just like Hari's or Vishnu's body. Sridhar Swami generally is the briefest of the commentators. Actually, that's not true. Jiva Goswami is also very brief. But Sridhar Swami doesn't do a lot of lengthy extrapolation from the text. His interpretation of the text usually sticks very closely to it. So he's a good place to begin reading because of that fact. He's sticking pretty closely to the text itself. And then others will take a statement like this, Vaikuntasya harereva murti yeshangte. These people who live there have bodies just like Vishnu himself. And they'll give a whole paragraph, extract. There's different kinds of mukti, for example, and sarupya mukti, receiving the body just like Vishnu, is an important kind of mukti, and this is the type of mukti that they've achieved. This is why it's being described here, etc., etc. So others will develop that theologically more. But Sridhar is often the starting point for a lot of people. The major exception to that is Vijayadvaja Tirtha, the Madhvait. He doesn't begin with Sridhara as his basis. Almost everyone else does. Vallabha half the time. But Vijayadvaja Tirtha is kind of like a point. He's not going to begin with Sridhara. He's very, very independent in his interpretive method. And therefore it's a lot of fun reading his commentary as well. Okay. Nimittam phalam pravartakam yasmin nishkamena dharmena ityarthaha. So the verse is talking about ye animitta nimittena dharmena aradhayan harim. These people worship Hari, aradhayan, by dharma, dharmena, that is animitta nimittena. And it's this play on words, nimitta and animitta, which Sridhar Swami is discussing here. And he says, basically, animitta means nishkama, without aspiration or without purpose in mind, without... It's not... The worship of Hari is not an expedient or an end to a means to another goal. It's not... Therefore, it's animitta, basically. Okay. Let's move on. I want to move to the verses with longer meters sooner rather than later, because that's where things get interesting. Number 15.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
On this one, where it says Vaikuntha bodies.
Yes.
Is there any comment in the commentaries on how these bodies differ from the bodies this planet?
How they're different from material bodies? No, the commentators don't ask that question. I believe one or the other commentator discusses. Yeah, they talk about what makes these Vaikuntha bodies different from Vishnu's body, considering that everyone says Vaikuntha bodies. Nearly every translator interprets it as saying it's not just the bodies found in Vaikuntha. But Vaikuntha here refers to Vishnu. So it's Vishnu's body, Vishnu-like bodies. So then what makes Vishnu's body different from the... Is there anything that makes it different? And they point to the Srivatsa and the Kaustubha, the gem that he wears and the mark of Lakshmi upon his chest that makes him distinctive. You can say, oh, that one's Vishnu, because you see that mark upon his chest. So it's very, very similar, their bodies.
If he happens to be wearing something that covers that, then you're in trouble.
Yeah.
You won't recognize.
Exactly. Okay, so 15. Yatra chadya pumanaste bhagavan shabda gochara satvam vishtabhya virajam svanam no mridayan vrisha. My translation. And there dwells Bhagavan, the original person, who is understood through scripture, Shabda Gochara. The virtuous Lord is situated in goodness, Sattvam Vishtabhya, that is free of passion, Virajam, and he delights us, his own people, Svanam Nom Ridayan Vrisha. Okay. Now, commentators, again, have relatively little to say on this verse. Things don't get interesting till the verses get more complicated. But one commentator in particular, named Srinath Chakravarti, has something very interesting to point out here. Basically, you see, Brahma is introducing Vaikuntha as the residence of Bhagavan. Okay, and Bhagavan is Vishnu, and this is why this world is what it is. He's the primary resident. But Srinath Chakravarti interprets this very differently, and for that I'd like to request Dr. Lucheheims to read a bit of Srinath Chakravarti on this verse, because his comments on this verse set the stage for what's going on next. So maybe if you can kind of explain a little bit in general as to Srinath's project in this verse for the group here, that'd be interesting. Srinath Chakravarti, I should mention, is the guru of Kavi Karnapura, who was the son of Shivananda Sena, who was a close associate of Chaitanya. So he's in basically the Gaudiya tradition. And his commentary is in many places very brief, but when he does write, then he does something very interesting. In other words, he doesn't take it upon himself to kind of go through the regular motions of a commentator, explain every word and this and that, and kind of give the understood, the general meaning. But he jumps in when he's got something interesting to say. And usually that interesting comment takes that verse in a very, very different light than other translators would. He's not at all embarrassed to interpret a text in obviously Gaudiya theological terms. Okay, he makes no apology for that, and he has a great sense of playfulness, commentarial playfulness, when he's interpreting verses according to a Gaudiya bent. So, Rembert, would you like to say a few words about that?
Okay, but I have to get into the Sanskrit then to show how it works.
Yes, please do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyway, I like this commentary. That's why he asked me. And I've been reading this for the past few years for my thesis and so on. Basically, Srinath is whole point in his commentary on the Bhagavata is at every point he wants to prove five teachings that he says these are the teachings of Chaitanya, and the Bhagavata teaches those five things, and I'm going to prove it to you. And at the beginning of his commentary he says, like every other commentator, he says, if you read Sridhara Swami, everything is clear about the Bhagavatam. That's sort of one of his introductory verses, as you know, I pay respect to Sridhara, you know, if you read his commentary, you'll understand the Bhagavata. And then he says, but I'm going to do something different. And I'm going to show you something else. And so one of the things, the first thing he wants to prove that the Bhagavata is teaching is Aradhyo Bhagavan Rajesha Tanayas, that the Bhagavan, the Lord who's to be worshipped, is the son of Nanda, is Krishna. And the second one is Tadhama Vrindavanam, and his abode is Vrindavana. And that's sort of that's what he's trying to do here. So for him, he'll you know, talks about Vaikuntha, but he's not interested in Vaikuntha. He's interested in Vrindavan, which is, you know, where Krishna resides. So he kind of what he does in this section, and he starts with this verse. This is the first verse he comments on in this chapter. He says, actually, there's two things described in this chapter. One is Vaikuntha, and the other one is Vrindavan. And in order to do that, this is sort of, in this verse and the next verse, he sort of builds up his case for why you can read it like that. And it's a little Perhaps you might find it a bit of a stretch, but it's very creative. So he says, Yatrachadhya Puman Aste, there and there, Yatracha and there, Adya Puman, the original person, Aste, resides. Bhagavan, he's Bhagavan. Shabda Gochara, and he's within the range of shabda of literally of sound, and Srinath is sort of in his commentary he says first of all in this beginning yatra puman aste there is this person but he says chakara avartaniya the cha the word cha has to be repeated. So he says, there's, you know, if you repeat how you get, there's both and. And so he splits the verse in two and he says, on the one hand you have Puman, the person, and on the other hand you have Adya Bhagavan. And that is Adya Bhagavan, the original Bhagavan, that is Krishna, he says. And Puman, that is Vaikunthanatha, he says, that is Vishnu, who resides in Vaikuntha. So that's sort of the first division he makes. And then he attaches a lot of importance to this Shabda Gochara. He's within the range of sound. And I was just looking at the other commentators now, and everyone seems to take Shabda here as Vedanta or Shastra or something like that, as scripture. He doesn't take it like that. He says it is within the range of hearing. He kind of, it's a bit complex what he does there, because he says you have two things that are being talked about here. On the one hand, Vaikuntha is within the range of hearing, but it is also in the range of sight. So he says one should add to this, what is implied is this is not just Shabda Gochara, but also Drig Gochara. It is within the range of sight. And
from where?
Well, he says that's implied. And the reason he says that's implied is because he says you have those two, and he qualifies a Bhagavan by Shabda Gochara. So Bhagavan is Krishna for him. So his Krishna is within the range of hearing. And he says the reason that the text says this is because for Brahma, the speaker of this section, Krishna is only within the range of hearing. He's only heard about Krishna, but he has not seen Krishna. He has not heard, he has not seen Vrindavan, but he has seen Vaikuntha. And there's he quotes some verse earlier in this book where Brahma has a vision of Vaikuntha. So he says Vaikuntha he has seen, but Bhagavan is Shabda Gochara. He's only within the range of hearing, so he has not actually seen him. I suppose, I mean, he has a lot of to say about the rest as well, but that's perhaps not so significant. But then what he does here is he says, so you have those two things. I mean, he reads a lot into the text, sort of, you know, adds ideas and so on. And, you know, he says the cha should be repeated, even though the text doesn't have it repeated and so on. the reason he does this is because then later on he can say, some verses he will say, this is a description of Vaikuntha. And some he will say this is a description of Vrindavan and Krishna, and some is a description of both. He will say they apply to both, but that's sort of the stage for him to sort of introduce this whole section.
Instead of talking about one thing, you get the commentator talking about two things, that's of course built on this Adya Puman Aste Bhagavan in this verse, where Puman is, in Gaudiya theology, is Purusha, which means, this is from the Pancharatras and the different Chaturvyuhas. Purusha is Vishnu, whereas Adya Bhagavan, or Adya, the original Bhagavan, is Krishna for Gaudiya Vaishnavas like Srinatha. And then with that cha there, he can split it. He can split Puman from Bhagavan, basically. And you get two different beings being spoken of here, Krishna and Vishnu. And therefore the description then applies to two different worlds, Vishnu's and Krishna's. And that's important because then he's going to go on and read this description in these two different ways. So when the next verse, let's read that together. He talks about this next verse talks about the forest in Vaikuntha. So for him, that's not Vaikuntha. That forest is clearly Vrindavana, because Krishna dwells within a forest. And the description later of palaces and gems, that's all Vaikuntha. So, so within that theological framework, it makes good sense to him. Now, let's just read this next verse, which will be a good place to stop, because text number 17 begins with the longer meters and a lot more involved commentarial attention to it. Okay. So, yatra naishreyasam nama vanam kama dughay drumai sarvartu shribhir vibhrajat kaivalyam eva murtimat. The forest called Naishreya sparkles there with wish-fulfilling trees. So yatra, this place. A lot of these verses begin with yatra because this is a 12-verse series of yatras, basically. Where this happens, where this is like this. Tatra, that's where the Kumaras went. So it's like 12 verses in a correlative construction, and then the correlative shows up later. So yatra naishayasam nama vanam, there's a forest by that name, kama duhair drumai sarvartu shribhir vibhrajat. So vibhrajat, this forest is sparkling, glowing, shining with wish fulfilling trees, kama duhair drumai, that sarvartu shribhir, they possess the beauty of all the seasons. So all seasons simultaneously present. And the forest is kaivalyam iva murtimat. It's like kaivalya with form. Kaivalya with form or with body. And you see I've got this grayed out because I don't know how to convey this this sense of kaivalya with form with all the rich implications that kaivalya has. Because this kaivalya being isolation, and this, you know, liberation that is isolating, and yet that now has form, and it's in the middle of this rich, variegated world. So it's a little difficult there to convey. Let's see here. Yeah, and. Sridhar Swami doesn't have anything very distinctive to say. I just want to see Vijayadwaja here real quick. Vijayadwaja defines Kaivalya here as Brahma Kaivalyam Amritam Aksharam. So this eternal, imperishable Brahma Kaivalyam, isolation within Brahman. Liberation. Brahma iti abhidhanam jnana pushpa sadhyatvan naishreyasam. Jnana pushpa sadhyatvam. Brahma iti abhidhanam. Right, so this is indicating abhidhanam. It's indicating Brahma here. And it's achievable by Jnana, Jnana Sadhya, this Naishreya forest. Right? So he's in other words, he's connecting Naishreyas with Kaivalya iti iva murtimat. And this is why I translated Kaivalya as absolute bliss, which I don't like very much, but it's the only thing I could think of here. Because the idea that Vijayadwaja is saying here and other commentators is that Naishreyas, that word, the name for the forest, means full of bliss or full of happiness. That's the name of the forest. So Kaivalya iva murtimat, he's saying that's basically describing Naishreyas, that forest, and defining what it is. It's like that absolute bliss of moksha in form, in body. It's like walking in to Kaivalya, basically, that forest. Kaivalya eva murtimat.
If Kaivalya is translated as oneness,
yes,
then it's the form of oneness.
Yeah.
Which is basically odd.
Yeah, well, it's there's a little bit of a the Bhagavata is definitely taking a jab at Kaivalya here. Mm. It's saying, you know, because you're right, it's paradoxical. Kaivalya being absolute, you know, solitary or unity or oneness, then Murtimat, then showing up in form, and that form too in a situation where you've got multiple forms, then what does Kaivalya mean? The whole thing's been kind of superseded and redefined. So it's it'd be a footnote for that. Okay, and let's just read the Sanskrit for the next verse as a teaser for what's to come, because our time's up, but we won't have time to get into it. It's when the Vasanta Tilaka meters begin. Vaimanika salalana charitani shashvad gayanti yatra shamalakshapanani bhartu antar jalenu vikasan madhumadhavinam gandhena khandita dhiyo pyanilam kshipantaha.
We have shashvad, vaimanika,
yeah,
salalana charitani, then you have shashvad?
Yes.
Yatra.
Hmm. Vaimanika salalana charitani yatra.
Yatra. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a variation.
Variation. Okay. That yatra is, of course, consistent with all the yatras and all the verses, but it's a bit uninteresting, I guess. I'm not going to read this because the read commentaries here. The plan for next time is as follows. I'm not going to try to read the text completely in order. What I'm going to do instead, today I wanted to kind of set the context for what's going to happen. But what I'm going to do is select a few verses, not too many actually, 4 or 5, maybe a bit more, which have, I've pre-selected because they have involved commentary and interesting issues with the verse or the grammar or the theological import or whatever. And we're going to skip to those verses, specific ones, in the description of Vaikuntha as well as in the cursing, and read those at length. So instead of a superficial read of 30 verses, hopefully what we can get is a more careful, in-depth reading of, say, 6 or 10 verses, where we can go to through different commentators and really observe how commentators differ, what things they agree upon, and so on. Because you need something. Like these verses we've read, frankly, the commentators are not interested. They're commenting on it by matter of duty, because certain words need to be defined, etc., but there's no heart there. In the verses where they show up, it really becomes quite powerful. And I'm going to pre-select a handful of those so that we can look at them and compare commentary and so forth. Because I hope this next session can be a bit of a practice of commentarial reading that I think might be useful for some of the Sanskrit students as well. Okay.
Thank you very much, Ravi. That's really interesting, sharing your work with us like this.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So pick up the next reading, which is Thursday, 27th of May.
Yep.
I'll have to phone in from Germany.
Okay.